Coming up on Tech Nation, you're listening to the first of our three-part Winter Archive series, featuring our most popular interviews. Today, the founding executive editor at Wired Magazine, Kevin Kelly. He's here with his book, The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. Then on Biotech Nation, we're looking for cancer cells, specifically metastatic cancer cells in the blood, which travel from one tumor site to another. A clinical study on women with metastatic breast cancer is enrolling now. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
I've always tuned out when anyone started talking about how computers will eventually develop consciousness. Really? As if anything that does things faster than a human is conscious? You just download the app on your phone and get the featured functions plus consciousness? It's right up there with downloading your brain, and somehow you will be conscious forever. Or rather, a copy of your brain will be in some way conscious for as long as nobody pulls the plug. But serious scientists are starting to talk about consciousness in a whole different way, from MIT to Princeton to Tucson to the New York Academy of Sciences. These are cognitive psychologists and neuroscientists, computer scientists, physicists and philosophers, all jumping into the fray. In some ways, the same old questions repeat themselves, and some have actually been resolved, or at least there seems to be general scientific agreement. For example, is your mind and your brain one and the same, or are they different? The agreed-upon answer at this point is that your mind is a result of your brain functioning. You're alive. Therefore, with certain exceptions, you have consciousness. There. Now, that wasn't so hard, was it? Well, brace yourself. From there, the consciousness folks are just getting started. I won't attempt to describe the theories, counter-theories, and proposed measures of levels of consciousness, but I did have a bit of personal breakthrough. By this definition, anything with brain activity can produce consciousness, as in your dog's brain. He welcomes you home, and he's so glad to see you. If you're a pessimistic sort, you don't call that consciousness. If you're optimistic, you argue that Fido believes he's human too. But we all know that your dog won't do this for the next joker through the door. It's you and only you. He's conscious of you, and that's what keeps us coming back for more. MIT's Max Tegmark has come up with an idea he calls perceptronium. The word perception reworked into a word we would associate with a state of matter, atoms bonded together in a particular way. And by state of matter, think about water. You start with water, you boil it, it becomes steam. You turn off the heat and it's water again. You freeze it and it's ice. Ice, liquid, steam, all are states of water. So the state of perceptronium certainly exists in living humans as well as dogs. But perceptronium doesn't have to exist in a living being at all. Just particular configurations of atoms all interacting with each other, like the electrical interconnectivities within our brains. And they have to be interacting in a particular way to get an activity that would be called consciousness. Uh-oh, I see where all this is going. If your brain operates on all these massively interconnected electrical pulses, and that gives rise to consciousness, that's what computers and chips are doing when they're plugged in and running. I'm still not a believer, but looking at these definitions, it occurs to me that a funny kind of consciousness can also occur when multiple people are together. Ever been at a particularly memorable party? Everyone comments at the time about the energy in the room. Everyone remembers being there and what it felt like in that moment. People who weren't there can only hear about it. It's a temporary consciousness of sorts, experiencing that we are there together. It's there, and then it's gone. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. You're listening to the first of our three-part Winter Archive series, featuring our most popular interviews. Today on Tech Nation, the founding executive editor at Wired Magazine, Kevin Kelly. He talks about the technological forces which will define our future. Then on Biotech Nation, we look at the work of Synvenio Biosystems, identifying rare cancer cells in the blood and their clinical study on women with metastatic breast cancer. Kevin, your book is The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. So 12 technological forces, not 10, not 3, but 12?
It's an arbitrary number. These are umbrella categories that I put a lot of related things together. There could have been 11, there could have been 15. It's not really that important. The idea is that there's handfuls. There's a dozen or so long-term trends that you could think of as long-term trajectories in technology, kind of like a bias. It's like kind of like a bunch of biases that technology has.
Well, first of all, you call them forces, which I think are better than trends. I always kind of look at trends as you're on the outside observing. Here's a trend.
Right.
But as you read the book, you get the sense that these technologies are not stopping. They're moving forward. They actually act like forces.
Yes, right. It's a force or an urgency like gravity, right? I mean, so this is what the word inevitable means. It's going downhill whether we want it to or not. There's a force there. But it's a kind of a bias or leaning. And therefore, when you're working against it, you're kind of like going uphill, so to speak. And a lot of people are working against it. The music industry, for instance, worked against one of these trends for years and years because the internet is the world's largest copy machine.
Yeah.
Anything that can be copied, it touches the internet, it will be copied.
Yeah.
And so you can't stop the copying. That's inevitable. It's just going to copy more and more. And so the music industry was copy protection and outlawing this and prohibiting that kind of stuff. It doesn't work because they were going against the grain. There was a gravity towards more copying. And so it took them 30 years to kind of beginning to accept the fact that they can't stop the copying. So the kinds of forces that I'm talking about are inevitable and large scale like that, in that similar sense that there's kind of a gravity to them.
And they interact. They're codependent, you
right.
say. And you could see how many times they need each other to be a fulfillment of
right.
what their potential is.
Right. So this is one of the trends, one of the forces is this idea that we're kind of moving to these ubiquitous screens that are everywhere where everything is more liquid and fleeting and ephemeral and flowing. That's unlike a book, which I just wrote, called The Inevitable, which is...
Do I have one of the paper copies?
Exactly. Which is fixed, finished, monumental in a certain sense. It's impermanent. It's permanent and so it doesn't change. Whereas on the screen, everything is fluid, moving, flowing. We stream our music. We stream our movies. We stream Facebook updates. All this kind of stuff is flowing. It's never finished. It's always in progress. It's being updated. And that is a different culture, really. And that's also dependent on these other things like flowing and intermixing and remixing. So there is a sense in which this is kind of an ecosystem of different forces. And they're all kind of codependent upon each other.
In fact, when you look at anything that's moving on a screen, you actually don't know if it's being replayed from some hard disk or some piece of vinyl, or it's flowing over the of the internet of something, you know.
Right. And one of the big innovations, I would say, in some senses, starting with the written language, which was this ability to reread something, to scroll back. I mean, we kind of scroll back when we're reading and we read again. Well, we've moved that ability to kind of go back into movies, moving images, sound, and more of our lives where we can kind of scroll back and rewind it. And that ability turns out to be really, really fundamental. And one of the reasons why commercials are now seen as an art form is because you can watch them anytime you want, rewind them, watch them over and over again, and things like the GIF loop, where you take some little moment and you just replay it again and again, you are able to study it and it kind of transcends itself. And so that is another aspect of the streaming, which we can actually stop and rewind, which is this magical thing that we only recently invented.
And we know from neuroscience that that actually rewires our brains just in the observing of it.
Exactly, right. So our brains are changing. There was a lot of studies that took peasants like in Bolivia who were living in the mountains that had identical lifestyles, were very poor, but one set could read and the other couldn't. And they did brain scans and found out the fact that being literate and being able to read actually rewires your brain. And there's no doubt that spending a lot of time on the screen, 8 hours a day, looking at the stuff flowing across, and then soon VR is going to rewire our brains for sure.
VR is virtual reality.
Right.
You know, we all have painful experiences from 10, even 20 years ago of virtual reality. Mm. If that was your idea of virtual reality, you're going to have to put that on the shelf.
Right. Yeah. So the virtual reality that I actually got to experience, probably like you, in the late 80s, was actually had all the components that we have now. You put the goggles on, the dark goggles, and then you put this little magical glove on that is reproducing all your hand movements inside the VR world. It was actually not so bad, but the problem was that technology, as crude as it was, cost $1 million. And now three little parts in your smartphone are repurposed in VR. The location, gyroscopes, and accelerometer, and GPS that tells you where you are, put it inside the VR goggles so you can track your head movements. And then the screens that you're looking at are actually basically the same technology on the high-res, dense retina displays on the phone. And then the little chips that do all the video processing, they're really lightweight and small. Those are the things that are inside these new glasses. And suddenly you can do virtual reality for a couple $100s, and now it's good enough to improve. And so it's going very, very fast.
Once you get it to the base level, then it can really take off.
It's good enough to improve.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Kevin Kelly, the founding executive editor at Wired Magazine. He's here today with The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. Will you also include the fact of being human? It's interwoven throughout all of this. Why didn't Google Glass just take off?
Yeah. I think there's two reasons there. To me, the big mistake they made was they had outward-facing cameras and they were recording things. And people were very, very uncomfortable in people recording them without them being obvious about it, like holding a camera in front of their face. And the second one is that there was a dork factor. It just kind of looked dorky. And this is going to be a challenge for the virtual reality gear because it really looks dorky. And whether people are going to be comfortable putting that on, sitting in an office to do a teleconferencing, it's unclear. But there are rapidly – it's good enough to improve and is rapidly going to – look more like a pair of sunglasses that are not recording outward and give you a good enough immersive experience that you'll put up with the the chuckles.
Well, one of the things that occurs to me is that in the early days of movies, you know, we realized that you show somebody 16 frames a second, they think it's moving.
Right.
So we've been, in many ways, putting way too more than a human can take in right. into a lot of these virtual reality systems and kind of forgetting how we put ourselves in a virtual reality all the time. I have one group I'm involved with, and pretty much monthly we have a Skype conference. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just on the phone. But people stretch all around the globe, and we are the best of friends in doing the work we have to do. And when I'm there, as I know when other people are, we're physically in that meeting. Mm. This isn't one of these things where people are dropping off because they're bored. We all want to be together. We all do one hour there. Humans are more than capable of putting themselves into something that doesn't exist.
Yeah, and I do a lot of Skype. Regular Skype, you know, working calls just as you do. But I have to tell you that my experience with the teleconferencing in VR really is transformative. And you were mentioning this our early experience or education with movies. So if Mickey Mouse, we're watching a movie about Mickey Mouse and he throws a baseball across the screen, we would be very certain that there really was movement of that baseball, but in fact, as you point out, there is no movement. It's just a bunch of still images in a row. And our brain is the one that concocts this certainty about the movement. And VR is a little bit like that in the sense that there are images given in such a way that our brain, way beyond our conscious brain, deep in our brain stem somewhere, we assemble this certainty that these things are present or that you're somewhere else or that you're there, this really deep-held conviction or emotion that this is present. And that is happening in teleconferencing too. So you've moved from just like observing that somebody's there to feeling like they're there. I mean, a really common virtual reality stunt is to put you in a room, you know where you're in a room, and then they drop the floor away and you're suddenly on the edge of this cliff, you know. And your brain is telling you, I'm just in the room that I was in a minute ago. But something else deep in you is telling you back away as fast as possible before you fall in here.
Yeah.
And so that feeling is what this technology serves. It serves not just the box. It's your box plus the brain is doing something very fundamental. And in the teleconferencing, you not only know that they're there, you feel as if they're there. And it's this feeling, this kinds of experiences, I think is a new currency in VR. That we're going to have this internet where we know things. It's the internet of information where we know this and we know that, and we're going to have an internet of experiences where we feel this and we feel that. And that's a huge, huge thing. So I'm predicting that VR, when it finally is implemented on a large scale, will be the most social of all the social media that we have. Forget about the people in the basement by themselves with VR. Yes, but they're going to be really connected and feeling things with other people.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Kevin Kelly, the founding executive editor at Wired Magazine. His journalism credentials are long, having written for The New York Times, The Economist, and Science, and his insights are always interesting, including his last book, What Technology Wants. He's here today with The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. Well, some of these forces needed new words, or at least they were new words to me, like cognifying. Mm. I love that word.
It is an English word, but it's pretty obscure. And it means, as I'm using it, to make smarter, because I looked around for some other words like smartify.
That sounds really dumb.
Smartening. And that's sort of what we're doing right now is we're making many things from the Internet of Things to our TVs to our cars smarter. And this cognifying is what we're doing. And I think there's a great parallel with cognifying and electrifying. So in the first industrial revolution, we invented something that I call synthetic power, artificial power. instead of having to build everything with our human muscles and the animal muscles, which only took us so far, you can only make so much, we actually made artificial power by harnessing, you know, hydroelectricity, hydropower, coal, and then petrol to enable us to kind of harness the work of, say, 250 horses, which is what you get in your car when you're driving down the highway. You just push a little button and you have 250 horses artificially produced, and you can drive wherever you want or make whatever you want with this artificial power. And then we electrified it. We distributed it in a grid, and anybody, anywhere, could just buy and plug, get as much artificial power as they wanted by plugging in and just paying a little few cents. And now everything that we've electrified, like we took a manual water pump and we added electricity and then we electrified it. Now we're going to cognify it by taking that pump and then adding artificial smartness to it. We're going to cognify all the things that we electrified, and it's going to flow like on a grid. We call it the cloud. And you'll be able to buy as much AI as you want. You won't make it yourself. You just purchase it to do whatever it is that you want. So the car, which has 250 horses in it, we're never going to add 250 minds. And that's called the self-driving car. That's the car that Google and others are making, which is you take 250 horses and you add 250 minds artificially, and then you have this self-driving car. So we're going to cognify all the things that we electrified by adding artificial smartness, artificial learning to it, and this is going to be basically a second industrial revolution.
It's interesting. I've been looking around lately, and I keep thinking that things are getting better. Part of it is they're getting smarter, but some part of it is that they're not as dumb as they were. I mean, with the chips in the United States all coming in our cards, for those places that you can actually stick the card in that doesn't have a little thing over saying not yet. You can't.
This is the credit card.
This is the credit card. You can't walk away without your credit card. Finally. And the hassles of walking away without your credit card. All of these things. Although, you know, I have to say I have to be right on top of it because I hate when it goes beep, beep, beep. It gets louder and louder. But there are so many things in so many different ways. We just didn't get the bare bones technology. It's starting to work really, really well and all together, and it's taken us some time. And I kept kind of coming back to that with some of what you were talking about, you know, like in remixing and filtering and all this. It's like we've talked about elements of these for some time, but until it's here and we're using it and a whole lot of people use it in their own way, people who, as you say, some of them can read and some of them can't, some of them can see and some of them can't, you know, until we get mass use, in a sense, they can't mature.
Yeah. And the other thing about the other important aspect of techno-literacy, this idea that becoming literate about how technology works is that technologies generally, as they succeed, they become invisible, right? So the Industrial Revolution, there was in the Sears catalog, the mail order catalog, they advertised the home motor, which was this big, you know, 15-pound monster that was going to motorize your home. Well, what happened to that? It was going to turn everything. Well, it succeeded. But they became invisible. There was 50 motors in your home, and you're not even aware of them, and you don't think about it. In the early days, companies had VPs of electricity because it was mysterious.
I like that title.
Exactly. It was mysterious, hard to use, dangerous. And so you had the VP of electricity, which, of course, went away because it became invisible. And then now we're going to have VPs of AI, right, for a long time, VPs of machine learning as we implement that.
Well, think about they used to have all the computers were in one department.
Right.
Now it's like really,
everywhere.
Really.
So they become invisible. So a lot of this technology is succeeding and we don't see it. So there's AI right now. But the problem with AI is as soon as it starts working and is successful, we don't call it AI anymore. We call it machine learning or algorithms.
Or that thing I need every day.
Right. So AI is constantly being redefined as that which we can't do yet.
Yeah, because there's AI all around us.
The stuff is already there. As soon as we can do it. We have Siri. We don't call Siri AI. 50 years ago, that would be the most amazing AI in the world. So once it works, we rename it, it becomes invisible. So part of what we're talking about is these things are actually here in some extent already. They've been working for 20 years. But what's happening is that they're just going to accelerate more and more, and I'm trying to make them visible to people.
Am I correct in reading your book that you think keyboards are going away?
Absolutely. I think the interface to this we're very rapidly going is both gestures, using your whole body and your fingers and your hands, and facial expressions and voice, so conversing. So there's a great interest right now on these bots, conversation bots, because if you have an Amazon Alexa, you can already see that the real way we want to interface with a lot of this stuff is just having a conversation, talking to it. And people ask, like, what will the internet be like in 20 years? This is the horizon of the book I'm writing, The Inevitable. And I would say that in 20 years, we'll see the internet as a presence that we converse with, that's there anticipating us and we're interacting with, not as a place that we go to, but as a presence that is near us. And so some of the watching us, watching our arms, our fingers, there's a couple little very cool little chips that have nano radar, and they're looking at your micro gestures in your fingers, like imagine you're turning a knob or something. And so our bodies will be the interface. And also, by the way, our bodies will be our passwords too. Just as we use about 20 different signatures in you, your face, your voice, your body movement, everything about you biologically has a signature, including your heartbeat, including how you walk. Those are all identifiable. And while one or two might be able to fake, you can't fake 20 or 30 of them just statistically. It's just
not
impossible.
Not capable of doing
right.
it. Yeah.
So our bodies will be our passwords. We'll come up and the thing will recognize me as me or not.
I get the our bodies are password.
Yeah.
In the middle is where I have problems. And I don't even know if it's the middle. Maybe it's the side. It's like, man, I keep writing. I write like mad. Mm. It is exhausting to speak. You know, just physically exhausting and a lot faster just to type something.
We may be typing, but not on keyboards is the way I would suggest that. We don't necessarily have to continue doing that as the only way, in the sense that you can use virtual mouse or virtual mice, whatever that word is, and other gestures to speed along and converse. So there'll be this combination of many things. Eye gaze is another thing. And this is what they use in handicap. People who don't have quadriplegics who are using the keyboard, they can actually see where their eyes are gazing. So all these things are going to be present.
I'm speaking with Kevin Kelly, the author of The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, we're looking for cancer cells, specifically metastatic cancer cells in the blood, and a clinical study which is now enrolling women with breast cancer. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. This is the first of our three-part Winter Archive series featuring our most popular interviews. I'm speaking with Kevin Kelly, the author of The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. Now, filtering. We've been told for years that these robots will just give us what we want. It turns out that's what they do. I mean, that's we're out there. Right. We're only looking at what we want. We can get whatever we want at any time. But
we don't know what we want.
We don't know what we want. We don't know what's out there at all. But you talk about intense personalization.
Hmm.
That's got to be a deeper level.
Yes. So there's several things about intense personalization. One is that this technology allows us to do something that has been forecast for 20 years. People have talked about mass customization before, which is that you can customize people on a mass scale. And that did not happen very well before, in part because the technology just wasn't ready for the idea. We can begin to do that more. But there's another element of personalization that I think is more fundamental, and that is that just as the internet is the world's largest copy machine, and anything that touches it will be copied and flow indiscriminately across it. The internet is also the world's largest tracking machine, and anything that can be tracked will be tracked. And that brings up quickly the issue of privacy, you know, or people, others, ourselves, each other, our friends, our companies, our government being able to track us. And here's the dilemma, which is that absolute personalization requires absolute transparency, right? That for me to personalize or customize my friendship to you, my service to you, whatever it is, I have to know about you. You have to reveal something to me to
which is what you did in the old days when you walked in and said, hello, Joe, I just moved next door.
Now, well, even before that, it's what you did in your tribe where there is no – everybody knew everything you did. And, of course, you were treated very, very individually. They knew every quirk, everything about you. There were no secrets. So we're actually comfortable with that because we evolved that way. So if you want to have very ultimately personalized stuff, you have to be transparent. If you decide not to, and I think we should have that choice, if you decide in this respect I want to be more obscure or hidden, then the corresponding price, so to speak, is you're going to be treated generically, like a number, like just another thing, not at all personalized. And so we need to have that slider, but they're tightly coupled. So you have generic treatment, privacy, you have extreme personalization, extreme transparency. And here is the surprise that nobody was really expecting, which is that when you give people that choice with technology, in general, people are pushing that slider all the way over to the personalization and the transparency.
Slam.
And the way I summarize this in a very flippant way is I say, vanity trumps privacy, right? Vanity trumps privacy. We want that personalization. We want to be treated as individuals. We're more unique than average. And therefore, I will make myself transparent in order to do that. And that's what Facebook is sort of about.
And in a sense, you have the feeling of being seen.
Right.
Which is
see me,
I'm real.
Right.
Which is an existential question.
Absolutely.
Always humans have asked.
Right.
I think my favorite of your technological forces is questioning. That's really great.
Yeah. We're coming up to the point very, very quickly when if you want an answer to something, you ask a machine. Right now, just think about the ways in which Googling and Wikipedia has sort of transformed our efforts to come up with answers. And we're now producing more and more input access to those with, like, Alexa, where you can just – Alexa, you know, she's in the background waiting for you to ask her a question about anything and do something, to the AIs that these big search engines are building, which are becoming – more sophisticated so they can understand natural language and are accessing more information. So I think we're coming up to an era when answers are cheap, accurate, ubiquitous, and just about free. And whenever you have this kind of abundance, then the things that become valuable and expensive are the things that are scarce. And what's becoming scarce in this world of ubiquitous, true, accurate answers is questions, a good question. a good question is the one thing that machines are not very good at making right now. And good questions are actually really the propulsion for most of the progress in the world. It's a kind of exploration. It's a kind of innovation. It's a way of seeing the world differently. And that's all part of asking a good question. And so I'm suggesting that as we move forward, that learning how to ask good questions is far more valuable than coming up with good answers, because the machines will kind of do that for us. So if you want, part of the techno literacy is learning how to ask really good questions, like yourself, like what we are supposedly taught in schools, but often are not. And I think what we'll see is this expansion in the human realm of this stance of questioning, exploring things that are not actually very efficient, by the way. Asking, exploring, trying things is inefficient. Efficiency is for robots. We're really good at wasting time, and that's what I think we want to get better at.
Well, we have to remember that if we're asking a Google question, we're looking for a fact.
Right.
This is right here. Boom, boom, boom. And there are some other kinds of search engines that do very interesting things, and we've did analytics to take a whole bunch of data and see if what we can pull out. But to me, the frontier of know thyself, whether it's individually or collectively, is the looking at all this and coming up with a question that is above facts, and ultimately being able to answer those. And that moves the line forward.
In my book, I actually have a kind of a short preliminary list of what makes a good question. And one of the attributes of a good question is that it leads to other questions. There's a little kind of a recursive sense there that it's kind of ever expanding, where you're a good question is prompting other new questions that one can ask. And of course, those, if they're good, then you have more. But there is a way in which this is sort of a way that's self-extending. You kind of are extending the territory with a good question.
Today, you pointed out, we have 4 billion cell phones, 2 billion computers, all linked together with, I guess we'd call it all the things in the Internet of Things. We got 15 billion devices linked together right now on the face of the earth. It's the beginning. The beginning's just beginning.
Yeah, it's day one. There's lots of things to say about that, but I spend some time talking about artificial intelligence, virtual reality, all these things coming on very fast. But here's the secret. There are no AI experts, artificial intelligence experts. There are a lot of people working on it, a lot of money, but there's no experts. There's no virtual reality experts. We don't really have no idea how this works. And so as we move forward into the future, I think I'm taking a 25-year horizon. In 25 years from now, the major technology that will be the topic of discussion, that we'll be organizing our lives around, has not been invented today. We're just beginning. We're just at dawn. They'll look back at this time in 2016, and they'll say, you thought you had the internet, but you didn't have the internet. You didn't even have that thing that we're making. You thought you had the internet, but that's just the infancy. That's just the newborn. Wait till you see what it grows up to be. So there's a great opportunity ahead in where we're going. But at the same time, I think we are making something that we could categorize as a very large planetary scale machine or a superorganism, because it's really don't have the words for it, because it's 7 billion people plus all their devices and this entire technium of internet of wires and the radio waves and a million devices all connected together. So there's this one large connected thing that will have some kind of behavior at that large planetary scale, which has happened a couple times already. Just a couple of years ago, there was something called the flash crash. So simultaneously, within a matter of hours, every stock market on the planet took a dip. It went down for half a day, and it came back up. It was a substantial dip. And nobody to this day knows what caused it. It was just this global hiccup. And so that kind of a phenomenon at the global scale is something we're going to see more of, where this, what the scientists call emergent behaviors at this new scale. And there'll be many beneficial things that will come out of that, and there'll be some dangerous and harmful things. That's the nature of what we do. But that thing is this new thing that we're just at the beginning of making. And I call it the holos, just for a short name, because it's humans plus the machines, and also to some extent the natural world, the Gaia, the interconnected, the codependent, kind of robe that cloaks the globe in life. That's also part of it, because we are a biological force. The technium is a biological force. So those three things form this very large holos that we are now at the birth of making. It will get bigger, faster, stronger, more evident, more visible. But I think that people in the future will envy us, looking back to this time and say, wow, you were there when it was first born. You were there when it was this amazing moment, like being back at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, when there were all these things people were discovering left and right, like electricity, all these things, and they could just go into their bedroom and discover something with the very little technology. We're sort of at that same moment. We're going to be discovering so many obvious things that people always say, I wish I could have lived back then.
I always wanted to meet De Morgan. Remember, yeah. De Morgan's laws with the, yeah, one and one? It was like, he was, yeah, there at the beginning.
Right. Well, we're here at the beginning. It's all opportunity.
Monetize the force if you're in business.
Right. And the way I summarize it is, you're not late.
I love it. Kevin, always a pleasure. Please come back. Don't be a stranger. We'd love to see you.
It's always a pleasure, Maury. Thank you.
My guest today is Kevin Kelly. His book is The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. It's published by Viking. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, we're looking for cancer cells, specifically metastatic cancer cells, which travel from one tumor site to another. It's difficult enough to have cancer, but when cancer cells begin to move to other sites, it's even more challenging to fight. Dr. Paul Dempsey is the Chief Scientific Officer of Synvenio Biosystems. I asked him, how do cancer cells travel from one site to another?
It travels in the blood, simply. The cells that are at the first site of where the tumor initially grows end up in the blood for a number of different reasons. Sometimes it's incidental. Other times it's an active program of metastases. Either way,
the DNA is driving it to move.
The cell mechanisms change, correct, and changes in DNA cause changes in the cell behavior, and so the cell becomes motile. And in the field, we call it the EMT, the epithelial to mesenchymal transition, where a cell goes from being sticky to being not sticky, and that's what causes it to move from its original site. It will end up in a secondary site as a result of that, and it's that movement that causes the all the morbidity that's associated with cancer. So it's a very active area of discovery, because if we can modulate metastases, obviously we can significantly affect disease. But the other aspect of that is that there are populations of cells in blood that reflect the active part of the disease that's moving. So it gives you a template and it gives you a cell population that's very informative of what's going on in the disease now. So you're able to make decisions that are different from if you just had a tissue biopsy sample where a doctor made a decision about what cells to examine, as opposed to looking at cells that are in the blood where the disease has made a decision about what cells should be examined.
So if you could identify a tumor, you could go in and get a biopsy and you might be able to get some information about what's there. But it doesn't tell you the state of the cancer in your body, about how it's moving or if it's moving, you'd have to look in the blood.
I think right now that's true, but it's also a little bit more – they're complementary. What we know about what's going on in a tumor sample, in a tissue tumor sample, is what has driven a lot of the medical treatment and medical practice that we're using now. These new templates that you can recover from blood, and tumor cells are just one of them, give you a different window into the disease process, because they're presenting a different aspect of disease and representing a different biology. So just like we've done in infectious diseases, we've been able to monitor a changing infection and modify the treatment based on what's going on a longitudinal basis. Now we're building the tools to do that in oncology as well.
So Cinvenio obviously has developed some tools to look at blood.
Correct. So we actually started as a spin-out from the engineering department at UCSB and had a platform technology that we used to recover effectively rare cells from blood. Now, rare cells can be many different things, but one of the more interesting applications is to look at rare cells that are derived from the tumor. And so we built a workflow that allows us to recover these cells and then sequence them. As is very prominent in the medical literature now, there are other templates that are that you can get from blood. Cell-free DNA is a nucleic acid that comes from dead and dying tumor cells that can also be recovered in blood.
So you can see that your tumor cells are actually dying.
So you're looking at the DNA that comes from the tumor cells that are dying someplace in the body.
Oh, right?
We don't know where. So that gives us one list of disease profile. And then the cells that are migrating and metastasizing gives us a second list of targets and potential therapies, and then the biopsy is a third. And these three together give you a much more complete picture about what is going on and what's changing over time and what's responding to treatment and what's coming back. At Cinvenio, we see them as complementary technologies. So the platform is a machine that allows you to recover two of the more important tumor templates that are recovered from blood. The cells, the rare tumor cells that may only be present at one or two per tablespoon of blood, and the fragments of DNA that come from the tumor, which are there at vanishingly small quantities. So both of these give you different views on the disease, but also have complementary biologies and complementary information.
How much blood do you need from a person to get a real good look?
You know, our test works
with... Isn't that a scientific term, a real
good
look?
No, but it really is a very important aspect. This has been in the news a lot of late because we're thinking about running tests with smaller and smaller quantities of material. But when you're looking for something that's very rare, you'll eventually run out of sample. And it's certainly an issue in cancer because these templates in blood are so rare. So our test works on a 10 mil sample. So it's a standard blood draw. It's not a greater volume, and it can be integrated into the normal testing series that are done. And its ability to give information is based on how sensitive it is and how specifically it is able to enrich a certain population of cells. But you can't reduce that in volume much more because there just aren't enough things there to find.
Yeah, if it wasn't passing by at the time.
It's right.
It's not
if it's
there.
Not there, there's no way to see it.
And if it ain't in the sample, you ain't going to find it.
Yes.
That's for sure. Now, obviously, there are many, many different kinds of cancers. What are you focusing on initially?
Our focus has been largely on breast cancer initially for a variety of reasons. I think the biology and the scientific literature supported that space. We're doing a clinical trial now in triple negative breast cancer where we're trying to apply this tool to monitor recurrence of patients who have been treated with curative intent. It's a very aggressive disease. We have 30% of patients who are treated will have a recurrence with an average of 2.8 years after they were treated. And right now, we don't have any tools at all except clinical presentation. So you're sort of sent home and told, well, wait till something happens, which is a very difficult thing to do.
And something that we can observe happens.
And there are things going on that we can see. So we're focused on breast cancer because that's where our initial trial, we had an NCI-funded trial to validate the technology, and now we're bringing it into a patient group to try and provide a window into the disease that is not currently there to say, here is evidence of a disease that is going to come back and will present at some time in the future. And having broken that cycle, now we can think about working with partners to come up with new ways of treating these patients to get to help them fight the disease earlier and more effectively as a result. Because in cancer, getting in early is the best way to have a bigger impact on disease.
Now, you just didn't do any breast cancer in general. You picked a particular set of subjects and for a particular reason.
We did. We built this platform around breast cancer. But within that disease, there are many different forms. And one of the places where we were aware that there were tools lacking was in the treatment and monitoring of triple-negative breast cancer. So we opened a study on March 3rd of this year, which is actually Triple-Negative Breast Cancer Day, to recruit patients to use this tool set to help monitor disease over time, to look for patients who had evidence of recurrence before it was clinically presented.
So they've already been diagnosed. They've been through treatment. How frequently are they monitored?
So we're actually doing this with a couple of different tools. We started with this platform, but now as Synvenio has grown, we're more and more interested in bringing to bear any set of tools that we can that will help provide evidence to patients and their doctors. So we're monitoring these patients with this liquid biopsy test either quarterly or annually, so at baseline and then one quarter in and then annually. But the study is paired with another test that we have at our shop that measures the immune response. And when the innate immune response, so this is the immune response that takes care of all the early infections and all the early challenges, not the B and T cells. When that immune response gets completely shut down, it's very well associated with an increase in tumor progression. So we're using that as an additional tool to help monitor the patients and index when we should be doing the sequencing test that's part of our liquid biopsy platform.
And how frequently do you test the immune system?
And that is done on a monthly basis. So that's a 1 cc draw. It's a very small amount of blood. It's a very easy assay. It doesn't take a lot of the patient's time or expense on the testing side, but it gives you a clear indication of where you're more likely to have a disease process restarting. And so we're pairing the two together to try and give more information to hone down the cost of the tools so that more patients are able to use it, and then use the molecular tools as information that eventually can be deployed to make treatment decisions as the trials progress to understand how best to respond to these patients.
How do you know which cells, or is that on a patient-by-patient basis?
No, this is actually the most important question because that is the definition that allows us to look at more and more and more different patients. We did a study last year that was published in March where we compared the cells that had been defined for the last 20 years with a new definition that was overlapping but different, and it was 300% better signal. So I think now that we have a machine and a platform that can allow us to define a tumor cell when it's present, we can elaborate on these cell populations much more easily. And we can find new populations that are informative because we're pairing the cell biology with the new sequencing technologies that are very, very powerful. So for that, I think we can think now about looking at diseases that traditionally haven't been approached very well by liquid biopsy, where cells are much more difficult to get hold of. And I think of examples like pancreatic cancer or ovarian cancer, where the epithelial to mesenchymal cells I've probably gone way too technical here.
You know what? I actually like that. We know you know what you're talking about. Yeah, and I think what's also important here is that while it's good for everybody to know that, you know, really on top of this, we can get that concept that things are screened and, you know, it's like, I get that and you can screen me. Once I've had this event, this occurrence, the idea that I can be constantly monitored, extremely important. But I think also now we'll go back to the business of biotech. Many times when someone comes in here with a platform, they say, okay, here's our platform. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. But a lot of people can use your platform. And so you've taken that platform and you've made it available through Thermo Fisher so that other people who may want to use it in other ways to study cells can do that. So the platform's available to the world while you're still sitting here looking very specifically at breast cancer.
Yes. So ultimately, people want solutions. And if you're a platform company, it puts its own limits on what you can do. The solution that we're focusing on now for the liquid biopsy is triple-negative breast cancer monitoring. But there are many people and many institutions and many groups who are looking for solutions in other diseases. So it doesn't make sense for us to try to do everything. And the emergence of next-generation sequencing technologies, of which Thermo Fisher is one of the proprietors, dovetails very nicely with the template that we're able to provide. So by selling the platform and providing protocols and experience, we can allow other people to do many of the things we'll never be able to get around to doing. And that's what will change the paradigm for patients and their treatment, not what we can do in our shop in Los Angeles.
And I think another part of the vision is that at the end of the day, it comes back to therapeutics. And you're saying we want to partner with anyone who has therapy so that this can together make that therapy as early as possible and as appropriate as possible.
Right. And I think I might actually use a different word to therapy, and I would broaden it to treatment because, again, the best outcome in cancer is when you can catch it earliest. And many of the earliest treatments are the doctors will make for their patient don't always include drugs. There can be, it can be surgery. It can be so there are other tools, but you have to be earlier in the disease, and you have to have monitoring tools to be able to track what's going on. So I think that the drugs and drug selection is a very important part of what we do now. But ideally, the way we want to drive this, and I think the way everybody working in the space wants to get it to, is to find things earlier so that you can cure rather than treat.
Well, Paul, fantastic. Please come back and see us again. We'd love to have an update.
Well, thank you so much for the time.
Dr. Paul Dempsey is the Chief Scientific Officer of Synvenio Biosystems. Synvenio is currently recruiting women with previously treated non-metastatic triple-negative breast cancer or previously treated non-metastatic breast cancer with a confirmed BRCA mutation who have completed therapy within the last 3 years. More information is available on the web at synvenio.com. That's C-Y-N-V-E-N-I-O, synvenio.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.